Welcome to the weekend edition of the Price of Business Show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. On today's program, we got a lot to cover, as always, and looking forward to introducing you to today's guests. But in addition to that, I do want to mention that the Price of Business, which is one of the longest-running business shows in the country, continues 24/7 at priceofbusiness.com. We are adding new content all the time. There you can see all of our regular guests. We have reoccurring guests from Fox Business, from Yahoo Finance, gentlemen like Cody Willard, who was a longtime CNBC and Fox Business anchor. He's on this program every single week. And so we're excited by the talent that we bring you. Also, I do want to mention I've got a book called Making New Rich Books Work for You, and exclusively for our listeners of this program. It's available at a ridiculously low price. If you want to get more information about that, go to priceofbusiness.com. If you read anything by people like Tim Ferriss or Robert Kiyosaki, who's been on my show many, many times, and you know, really were excited but had little to show for it when you try to pursue those things, my book explains why. There's something going on, and the problem really isn't with these authors. It's usually with the reader. And you can get more information about that at priceofbusiness.com. With that, here's our first guest right here on The Price of Business.
Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business. I want to remind you, the show never ends at priceofbusiness.com, where you'll find great audio, video, articles, and more, including interviews with my guest this segment, Lee Kaplan. He is a longtime regular, a show favorite, a personal favorite, someone we can get good feedback about. Lee, great to have you back on the program. Some of my best interviews around the topic today, which is redistricting, I call it redistricting on steroids, has been with you. I've really enjoyed those conversations. And so when I saw what is happening in Texas, I instantly thought of you. But before we get to our topic, if you could take 1 minute to tell us about your firm and the best website for people to learn more.
Thank you. It's Murphy Ball Stratton. We are soon to be 11 lawyers. Everyone in our firm clerked for a federal judge, in most cases for federal appellate judges, including a Supreme Court clerk. And we basically handle all disputes, litigation, arbitration, mediation, amicus briefs, and we're ready to go to trial. We found the best way to resolve cases is to set them for trial and not to delay, which is contrary to some people. But we have a lot of people with moxie at all age groups. I happen to be the eldest lawyer, but I wouldn't claim to be the best lawyer. We have brilliant young people working for us. It's mbssmartlaw.com, and we can be reached on the internet there, and I would encourage people to look at our firm biographies and just see what people have done.
Very good. I encourage people to do that as well. We have got an interesting situation unfolding in the state of Texas, and Trump is on the phone, I'm sure, with governors around the country that have that, you know, it requires really multiple things. The House control, the Senate control, and the governor control all be under Republicans to do what he is trying to do, which is to win the election by redistricting, because you don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that his Congress, particularly the House, is in an existential crisis based on what's going on in Washington, D.C. today, without doing these extraordinary, I say unethical, doesn't appear illegal measures of redistricting in the middle of a decade and doing it specifically for the purpose of the targeted purpose, like in the state of Texas, to get a net five seat increase in order to hold on to a very fragile majority in the House. And so, you know, there's I can't remember. I had the number last week. I'll look it up even while you're talking. But there's a lot of states that meets that criteria And I don't know. I don't know how many are going to go for it. I'm hoping that there's more reasonable governors in other states who like this could come back to haunt us. That's at least how I should look at it. Your thoughts on the whole process, away.
Well, the sad thing is that neither party listens very well. And the sadder thing is that neither party is really willing to have a redistricting commission set up when they are in charge, because they would rather have gerrymandered districts that help everybody. A lot of people forget the meaning or the origin of the word gerrymander. There was an Elbridge Gerry in the Northeast, I think Massachusetts, and somebody said this district, which was drawn in a way that he thought would be helpful, looks like a salamander. And so people called it a gerrymander, and we got a new word in the vocabulary, a word that I love. And candidly, if you look at some of the districts in Houston, they are shockingly disproportionate, not in terms of the number of people, but in terms of their shape. At one point, Sheila Jackson Lee had a district that looked like some kind of a pitchfork, where people were reaching to put minority voters in that district. And as it turned out, that district is now, I think, about 55% Hispanic, maybe 50%. And Sheila had a hold on that district. But things are changing. And so now the excuse for doing something is always everybody else has done it. Look what they did. And it reminds me of people who are fighting under mother's skirt while she's trying to be on a telephone and she's trying to separate two children who are saying, he did it first, he started it. And I just wish that some people would rise above that in the Texas legislature. It's clear that the governor will not do that because of his own aspirations. So when the president calls up and says, I need five more seats, the governor just says, let me see how I can oblige you. You contrast that with Governor Kemp in Georgia, who told President Trump in no uncertain terms, I can't find 11,780 more votes for you to tip the election. Now, whether that'll ever happen again, I don't know. But I see us descending into hyper-partisanship if we're not already there. And that's very dangerous.
Oh, yeah. How do we get any more hyper than we are without getting, you know, I almost said without getting violent. We know it's getting violent.
Right.
We know there's threats against people for their political views. Yeah, if we're any more than we are now, we are going to be falling into third world country status entirely. And there's some third world countries that would be offended by the comparison, I'm afraid, when they look at how we are today. So there's 23 states.
I don't see
states.
How you can be offended. How can you be offended? This is what we do now. And it's shameful.
Yeah, when I say offended, the third world country offended by the comparison.
We're
not like you guys. What are you talking about? I mean, it's really outrageous how we are. 23 states.
Is there
states.
A bridge too far? What's interesting is you have a few rebel members of Congress who want the Epstein files to be released. And, of course, that's because Trump stirred that up, and a lot of people jumped on the bandwagon, and Trump is now fighting that. I have little doubt, personally, but this is my own personal prejudices, that those files will hint at Trump being someone who also consorted with underage girls. And the question is that a bridge too far for the Republican majority? The speaker obviously didn't want to know, and he adjourned the House early, and we're like a banana republic. So will the Republicans in Texas go along? I think they will, and nobody is going to put the brakes on this. So the governor has the right to do this, technically, and I think the governor will be quick to make that happen. And then we'll see whether there'll be any kind of a revolt among the voters in November of 2026. I don't know that there will be.
Oh, well, is there anything like the town hall meetings we're seeing
like the one in California, in a district that voted 65% for the Republican congressman there. They had 600 people, which was unheard of for a town hall, and they were calling him a lot of words that I'm not allowed to say, thanks to the FCC, and they were calling him continuously a liar. The GOP is in a serious crisis. That's why the Republicans are treating Trump like a genius because he's doing this creating five new Republican Congress people out of thin air. I call it pure desperation, and a guy who's operating with messaging that doesn't work for typical Americans. That's what I see. But, you know, again, I'm kind of an anomaly in our current culture. So I looked it up, and there is what they call a trifecta state. So in other words, House, Senate, and President are controlled by either Republican or Democrat. 23 are under Republican control. That's a lot. And virtually none of them have separate commissions or panels that determine redistricting. California, and the Governor Newsom is threatening to do the same thing there. He's got to get off of their constitution, thanks to referendum, the commission that's now in charge of that. He'll probably pull it off because Californians hate Trump as a majority. But, you know, that's going to be a challenge there. New York has an even bigger challenge. They'll say it'll be at least two election cycles before they can change it there. So none of the Republican states, to my knowledge, have an independent commission who are trying to create objectivity, something you and I both talked about in favor. So this is, you know, really a huge advantage for MAGA, for the MAGA wolf.
Whenever is in power, they say the minority says, you'll be sorry about this someday. And the party in power always disregards that. And yeah. My goal is to get the party in power once in a while to pay attention to what the minority is saying, because the worm does turn. And you can only stave off the future forever in Texas. Sooner or later, there will be a time when the Supreme Court will come around and they will reverse the decision that allows significant gerrymandering. The Constitution says states are supposed to have a Republican form of government. And I guess a republic is one where the majority can ride roughshod over the minority. We'll be sorry about that. I think Chief Justice Roberts made a serious error when he did not require relatively compact districts to be created in North Carolina. And now It's being used against virtually everybody, so that every state is going back and forth, or I say not going back and forth, but going into what I would call the wrong direction. And saying, well, You did it and you're going to do it, is not an answer. So I hope Governor Newsom does not try to redistrict. I hope New York and Illinois do not try to redistrict in a way. We ought to do it every 10 years, and we ought to require relatively compact districts. Now, that's hard to do line drawing, but we need to do it.
Yeah, no, that question about it, by the way, just for clarity's sake, in Article 4, where it talks about a Republican form of government, that's a small r. It has nothing to do with party. It meant rule of law. But I agree with you. You know, you've got a party that is trying to hijack that Constitution, you know, and we've heard about, no, America's a republic, not a democracy. We've heard of that ad nauseum. Frankly, since the 1860s, U.S. has been more and more democratic, although I wish we had more choices for offices than the two parties we have. So, that's really very, very much an existential-type crisis. There's nothing normal about the way things are being conducted today. And the level of lack of alarm among the electorate about how really bizarre things are, I find very disheartening.
Absolutely. It's frightening, and it bodes poorly for our democracy. I would like for some president to rise above, and I don't have any real hope that the current president will. Other presidents were less proactive about this, but now in this atmosphere, that's something people are all willing to do. And if, as I expect, the Democrats win the presidency the next time around, or the House of Representatives, I hope that they will refrain from what I would call revenge redistricting. It's scary.
Yeah. And one of the big problems, and we're not even getting into it, we're just focusing on the fact that this is only being done for the Republicans to maintain control and get more control, and because they know they're not going to be politically popular enough to maintain what they have. In my opinion, they know that. You know, you look at the history of off-year elections, you look how narrow the margins are, you look at the hostility in these town hall meetings, the writing's on the wall. So essentially cheating, you know, may not be illegal, but in my opinion, unethical is the only way they can maintain it. And we're not even going to talk, we haven't even talked about, and we should as we need to wrap it up soon, the fact of how poor the representation is going to be if they do this. They are going to have more Sheila Jackson Lee type members who I consider to be, frankly, an embarrassment, you know, where they are Democrat wackos, just like there's Republican wackos. When you have a district that is so overwhelmingly one party, the contest in the primaries is to get the one that's most extreme. And so this poll, it's going to make it more extreme, create more extremism. That's the big problem with the way we do redistricting now. This approach that we see now is going to multiply that factor, that effect, I think.
Right. We're not well served by the current atmosphere and the disregard for the truth. I mean, when we have President Trump federalizing soldiers to patrol D.C., when in fact D.C. crime is going down, that's scary. It's stupid and it's scary. And when we have a house like that, then if there's ever a deadlock, the house will pick the president, and the house is not competent to pick a president. They're so parochial. And that, I say that about both parties. I think there are people in both parties who are an embarrassment to our entire system. And we shouldn't allow that. Or at least we should try to make it harder for that to happen. And I don't know what the solution is unless there is an outright rebellion against that kind of thinking and that kind of behavior. So we'll see.
Yeah.
I'm hopeful that things will change this next time around.
Hope is better than the alternative. That's for sure.
There you go.
I just think the House is an absolute disaster. I worked in the Senate back in the 80s, had lots of friends who worked in the House. It was a zoo back in the 80s, but now it's just a three-ring circus, an ugly, violent one at times. I'm just in shock on what it's like. And, it's just a very strange and sad political environment today. Lee Kaplan, final thoughts as we wrap it up.
My final thoughts are that the House, despite redistricting, will flip to Democratic hands because people will overreach. My second final thought is that sooner or later, the Epstein files will get out. And even though Speaker of the House, Johnson, doesn't want that to happen and wants to keep his eyes closed, it will get out. We live in a society that is sufficiently chaotic, disorganized and open, that somehow we will get more information, and that will include information about the president's dealings with younger women.
Yeah, you know, we haven't heard from Anonymous for quite a while. This sounds like something they would be really interested in.
So, well, they might.
Yeah, them or someone like them. Yeah, this is kind of right up their alley. Lee Kaplan, thanks so much. As always, I am Kevin Price. You're listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business Show. Stay tuned for more after this. I'm Kevin Price. You're listening to the nationally syndicated Price of Business program.
Marianne Fairmouth, she's a regular on the Price of Business Media Network, and we love having her on the program each week, bringing her insight, particularly from her book that I consider revolutionary when it comes to recruiting. You can learn more about Marianne over at Fairmouth, that's Fairmouth.com.
I think the biggest thing that leaders need to recognize is that questions are their superpower. If they use more questions and tell less, I say ask more, tell less, then all of those things happen right there. How do you avoid micromanaging? Well, if you ask people, hey, what are your expectations? What do you see this? What do you need? When can you have this by? What do you need for support? How often should I check in with you? If you do all of those via questions versus statements, all right, hey, this is what I need it by. I'm going to come here. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. Then that's how you develop that trust and you get better results through asking questions versus telling. And it's a challenge for people because we're just so used to telling and we think that leadership is all about telling when the exact opposite is true. It's about asking. And the more questions you ask, the less you micromanage and the better results you're going to get.
There are opportunities for our work and careers everywhere if you know where to look. That's easier said than done, especially in our fast-paced and constantly changing world. Marianne Fairmouth is talking to experts, employers, and job seekers to bring you insight and understanding about what's possible. This is Career Can Do, where we're navigating the new work world.
Welcome to the Career Can Do podcast, a top global podcast dedicated to helping you navigate the new work world. My name is Chris Sandlin, and I'll be the host for this week's episode. Today, I have the pleasure of sitting down with Ken Smith, who is an executive and leadership coach and the owner and founder of Bel Air Leadership, which is a service-connected, disabled veteran-owned small business that partners with organizations to improve leadership effectiveness and increase results. Ken, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet, Chris. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Today's episode is all about leadership. Building the next generation of leaders, sharpening the skills of existing leaders, and giving them the tools to take their leadership skills to the next level. So my first question is, what are the three questions everyone asks about their leader?
Thanks, Chris. So the framework on this and the idea behind this is that subconsciously, we always look at our leaders and we think about, are they doing well? Are they not doing well? Are they effective? Are they not effective? And I come up with these three questions is that people ask themselves about their leader. And the first question is, are they competent? Incompetent meaning competent in their leadership skills, not necessarily the technical skills that the employee is doing, but in their leadership skills, setting good goals, holding people accountable, managing and resolving conflict in a healthy way. Those are leadership skills. The second question people ask is, do they care about me? And care is one of those things that you can't fake. You either do or you don't, and people see that. And if you're not sincere and they don't see that you care, then they're not going to be as willing to follow you. And the third question is, do I trust them? And I like to say that trust is gained by the inch and lost by the mile. If we have a leader and we don't feel like we can trust them, then we're less likely to believe in them, less likely to want to follow them, and less likely to believe that they're an effective leader.
I couldn't agree with that more. I love that quote. Trust is gained by the inch and lost by the mile. That's a wonderful quote. I'm going to definitely use that going forward. Some people will say that leaders are born. Others say that leaders are made. What is your opinion?
I'm a firm believer that leaders are made, never born. And I believe that leadership is a set of behaviors, good behaviors that you have to have. Now, for some people, these behaviors, like giving good feedback, just come naturally, and they're easier for people. Some people, it takes a little bit more energy, takes a little bit more effort, and they have to learn how to do it better. But to me, it's learnable, it's teachable, and there's no such thing as a born leader. Just some people do them a little bit easier than others. But everybody who wants to is capable of doing them.
Yeah. I always like to think, you know, you look at athletes out there, and obviously there's some very talented athletes, but it's not without them putting in the time and the effort and the energy, right? You know, people do have natural abilities, but it takes work and skill and to go out there and hone your skills and refine your skills. So I definitely agree with you. If you go out there and you work hard enough at something, you can definitely develop those skills and become really great at something, including being a leader.
Yeah, and I think that the other thing with that is you brought up athletes, and I use the same analogy in leadership. All that great athletes, they got a coach. And I think that that's the value in somebody like me is that you get an opportunity to share what's going well, what's not going well. You get an opportunity to see how to do it differently. You get some feedback from an outsider looking in to say, hey, here's what I observed. Is this what you want? Is this giving you the desired results you want? If you're not getting the results, what are you willing to do differently? What's that look like? And how do you have to go about doing that? So that's the beauty of what I love doing, is that I'm there to help people change their behavior. And I do that in a very healthy way that doesn't break them down, but yet makes them feel valued and they're willing to open up and change their behavior.
That's fantastic. So Ken, leadership is easy, or it feels like it's easier when times are going great, right? We're making money, we're being successful, things are coming our way and working in our favor. Being a leader seems to be easy, but I think sometimes what really defines a leader and makes them stand out is what they do when times are tough. So talk about what it means to be a leader through tough times as well as through the good times.
So I like the phrase, leadership is simple, but it's not easy. The things that we need to do are basic, and we've known what to do for thousands of years. The Greeks wrote about it thousands of years ago, but it's about doing it when it's hard, like you said, when things are really, really busy. Are we still taking the time and providing people that feedback? Are we still coaching people, even though we have this limited amount of time? Are we making it a priority, and how are we prioritizing things when we have limited opportunities or limited abilities? And to me, it's about making deliberate choices, because what we have to do doesn't change. We just need to make better priority choices and decide, well, what am I not going to do so that I can continue to do these important leadership tasks?
Yeah, understood. Do you see common challenges across industries, or obviously you have dealt with a wide variety of people in your career and seen a lot of different leaders, emerging leaders? Is there a commonality between people that transcends industries or transcends the business that they're in? Or do you find that leadership kind of has its niche qualities? Like in certain industries, you think that this particular trait is more powerful or more successful than in other industries?
I think that leadership is fairly industry agnostic. The same kind of challenges transcend when I listen to organizations and I listen to the challenges they're having, plus or minus, you know, about 5%, I can tell you these are the challenges that you're going to be having in your organization. At an individual level, the one challenge that I'm hearing a lot lately is, yeah, we're having trouble holding people accountable. And what that manifests itself in is, you know, poor quality products, late deliveries, poor customer satisfaction. And that also translates into a very poor workplace and a low morale in the workplace, because if you're the person delivering and other people aren't delivering, but nothing's happened to them, well, why should I work so hard when nobody else is and nothing's happening different?
And what do you diagnose the problem? Is it a misalignment of incentives? Like, why do you think that problem exists in the first place?
So my framework for accountability is a four-part accountability system. The first part is clearly establishing the expectations. The second part is gaining commitment for those expectations. The third part is inspecting. And the fourth part is providing feedback and consequences. When I talk to leaders and I talk to organizations, I'll often ask the question, which one of these four steps is the most challenging for you? And what I find is it's fairly even across the board. There's no one step that stands out that says this is the one across the board we need to fix. It's very individual and very unique to each person as to which one of those that they struggle with. And as I look at an organization or an individual who's struggling with accountability, I look at those four steps and which one do we need to do better? Fix one step at a time, get better at that one step, and then figure out, okay, well, which one's next do we need to work on?
In your coaching, what's a story where you were going through an exercise, you were going through a session, and it resulted in kind of a breakthrough moment? Can you share a little story?
Yeah, I'll share a story about Patricia, one of my clients. And I was working with her and been working with her for several months and talking with her about leadership skills and going through a lot of these really important leadership skills. And then one day, in the middle of one of these skills, she says, hey, Ken, what if I don't want to do any of these? So I asked her the question. I said, well, Patricia, are you sure you want to be a leader then? And after a very long pause, she said, no, I don't. I don't want to do any of this. So it may seem counterintuitive, as a successful coaching engagement is one where I helped her recognize that she didn't want to lead, but yet it was still very impactful because the impact it had on her life, all of the stress that she now let go of, finding what she really wanted to be doing and recognizing that her passion was in, she's in the recruiting. So her passion was really in the recruiting, not in leading other recruiters. So in that aspect, the coaching may not have created a better leader, but in a lot of ways, it created better behavior.
Self-awareness, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I like telling that story and the fact that the power that coaching can have, because coaching is all about asking those tough questions It's not about having the solutions and telling people what to do. It's about challenging them, challenging their own reality, challenging their own thought process, and helping them see things that they didn't recognize before. And that happens both in good coaching behaviors and that, as well as it happens in recognizing, hey, that's not what I don't want to do. You know, in that positive coaching aspect, I had a client that said, you know, I'm tired because everybody comes to me and just wants me to solve the problem. And so I asked that challenging question, says, well, so what do you do when they come to you and they want you to solve the problem? So she says, well, I solve the problem. So I ask you the question, and what does that teach them? And you could just feel the energy change. She's like, that whenever they come to me, I'm going to do it for them and solve the problem. And yet here you are complaining that that's the result you're getting. So we got her to change her behavior a little bit, where she started then saying, okay, don't come to me with just tell me what your problem is. You have to have an idea about what you want to do about it first, and I'll walk you through that and give you some ideas versus just jumping right in and being that problem solver. So it was a profound impact on not only her leadership, but on her team as well.
And to your earlier point, Ken, you know, the question was so simple. It's, you know, anybody could have asked the questions that you asked, but it's an outsider's perspective. When you're in the moment and you're going through things like that and you feel the stress, and you don't feel like there's a solution, it can be really hard to take a step back and sort of self-evaluate and try to identify how you can be better. When you bring an outside party in like yourself, who can kind of see things more independently, you know, more emotionally removed from the situation, it's very compelling how you can ask such a simple question, and yet it has such a profound impact.
It does. And then the important impact on that is that people oftentimes are hesitant to share their struggles. And if you have a great coach, they'll allow you to be able to share without fear of judgment.
Yeah.
And that's a huge value add for somebody when they can share that, hey, this is not going well for me, and realize we're going to hold you accountable. We're going to help you through that, but we're not going to ask questions like, well, that was pretty dumb of you. What'd you do that for?
Yeah, understood.
Figuring out how do you grow those skills in people.
When we kicked off the show, you talked a lot about trust. You mentioned trust is a major pillar of how you build and create and maintain a successful leader. So how do leaders develop trust? What are the stepping stones that lead to a life and a legacy that you lead with trust?
So an interesting counterintuitive thing about trust is that oftentimes we say, oh, people need to earn my trust. And I say that it's the exact opposite. You must first give trust before people can become trustworthy. So the first step in earning trust and becoming more trustworthy is giving trust yourself without any expectation and just giving trust. You earn more trust and you maintain those trust by being consistent, by following through with your honor and your commitments, by getting results done. People aren't going to trust you if you can't deliver. You have to deliver still. Having some consistency, some transparency, and a little bit of empathy, and being able to put yourself in their position. Those are the ways that you earn trust. And granted, in all of these discussions, never did I say, let people get away with stuff. Earning trust isn't about, you know, letting people do anything they want. It's still holding them accountable. It's still giving them hard feedback, but it's being consistent. And you really have to, you know, lead the way that you want them to do and set that example first. And all of those things, when you put all of those things together and that accumulation of all those interactions that you have with somebody, that builds trust. And any opportunity where you don't demonstrate those things degrades that trust.
It's a really compelling point to say, in order to gain trust, you have to give trust and put trust in somebody else to allow them to take something like that and take that responsibility and go with it. To your point, the way that you sort of manage all of that is you want to make sure you're always providing accurate feedback. And the feedback loop can always be challenging for some folks to deliver feedback, because sometimes feedback is hard. Sometimes feedback is not favorable. Sometimes it's very favorable, but sometimes it's not. And so one thing that you kind of mentioned a little bit earlier is, you know, feedback is so important. And what I will tell a leader, what I'd like to say to leaders out there is, while feedback is uncomfortable, it's important for the person on the other side of the table to know how they did, what's going on. But I also think it demonstrates an element of caring, right? If somebody is willing to sit down with you and say, hey, I gave you this opportunity, here's what you did well, here's what I want to see you do next time, even though the conversation may be challenging or difficult or uncomfortable, it shows, or hopefully it shows, the person on the other side that, hey, this person is actually taking an investment in me, wants to see me do well, wants to see me grow. And so my message to leaders out there is, while those conversations may be uncomfortable, I think the light at the end of the tunnel will tell you that, hey, if you stick to it and you do it in a way that shows empathy and care and commitment and investment, while it may be uncomfortable at first, it should and hopefully will lead to long-term dividends.
What I tell leaders is that feedback is a gift, and it's a fantastic gift. And when you give people this gift, you're giving them your time, you're giving them your energy, you're giving them your thoughts, you're giving them your courage, because oftentimes it takes courage to provide feedback. And the same is true when somebody else provides you any feedback. They are giving you a gift. And I had one client, she said, hey, I need to have a difficult conversation. She said, I got to call out my boss. She crossed the line. And I dug a little deeper and said, well, what's going on? She said, well, my boss said that sometimes I come across as entitled. And so I asked her again, hard questions. Well, one of the things you've mentioned before is that you don't get much feedback from your boss. If you go and call her out for this one, what's the likelihood that you're going to get more feedback in the future? In long pause, probably none. And so I encourage her to reframe what she's thinking and not necessarily look at, do you agree or disagree with the feedback first, but accept it as a gift and then decide, well, what do I want to do with this feedback? And what she found out when she accepted the feedback and then talked to some of her team, she realized how some of her interactions could be improved. And she never would have gotten that without that feedback. So absolutely, feedback is the greatest gift that we give people and that we receive from people.
Going back to the trust, when you initially want to give somebody trust and you're starting to develop that relationship and give them the ability to go out there and succeed, how do leaders foster a culture of accountability or giving somebody trust and letting them take a full accountability of it and run with it without micromanaging? Because I think a lot of times what will happen is, you know, leaders will give assignment or they'll give a task or they'll give an objective, especially in the early days where trust maybe is not 100% there. The leader sometimes may feel compelled to over-engineer, over-manage the situation to ensure the outcome results in their desired, you know, achievement. How do you view that? Is that an effective style of leadership? And how do you foster that culture without providing too much micromanagement?
I think the biggest thing that leaders need to recognize is that questions are their superpower. If they use more questions and tell less, I say ask more, tell less, then all of those things happen right there. How do you avoid micromanaging? Well, if you ask people, hey, what are your expectations? What do you see this? What do you need? When can you have this by? What do you need for support? How often should I check in with you? If you do all of those via questions versus statements, all right, hey, this is what I needed by. I'm going to come here. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. Then that's how you develop that trust and you get better results through asking questions versus telling. And it's a challenge for people because we're just so used to telling, and we think that leadership is all about telling when the exact opposite is true. It's about asking. And the more questions you ask, the less you micromanage and the better results you're going to get.
We spend a lot of time talking about how to cultivate, you know, existing leaders and how to build on existing leadership skills. But let's talk a little bit about somebody who's out there who may be junior in their career, just starting out, or maybe freshly graduated college, or they've been in a particular role for a moment and they're looking to take the next step in their career and move into management, move into leadership opportunities. What do we say to them? How do they begin to step away and step out of sort of the day-to-day boots on the ground type of activity and role and mindset and start to elevate themselves to being a leader?
I like using the analogy. Oftentimes we give people the keys to the car, but we don't teach them how to drive. You know, we elevate the best person in the position and expect them to lead. So I would say, you know, be intentional with that and figure out, well, I need to learn how to drive. The skills that I've used in the past aren't the skills that are getting me to these roles. Well, what are these new skills that I need to be able to do? Well, okay, we talked a lot about feedback. That's a critical skill. Hey, I need to be able to communicate effectively with people. I need to be able to give instructions in a manner that's effective. I need to be able to listen well. I need to be able to understand what drives people and what fires them up and how to inspire them. I need to understand how to resolve and manage conflict in a healthy way. I needed to know how to establish priorities for people. So I look at this and it says, what you have to start doing is knowing the skills, figure out what that skill gap is, where are you at now? Where do you want to go? And then what's the development process to get there? And who do you need help with to go there? And sometimes they need to be shown how to do things. You know, you can read all the books in the world and they're great books. And, you know, you can learn what to do from those books, but how to do it, that requires a human interaction. So seek out people to show you those skills, show you what right looks like, and start practicing them. And be okay getting it wrong. It's an iterative process. You're going to mess it up. You're going to get it wrong. That's okay. That's life. That's what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to get it wrong in the beginning. But it's about having those right people there to give you the feedback and help you along and then do better next time and keep doing better.
I think the most of the learning happens when things go wrong, right? I think if things are going right, you don't really know all, you don't necessarily identify all the skills or the gaps or where you need to take yourself to the next level. It's in the failures. It's in the, when you fall short, that you really do that self-evaluation and understand, hey, this is where I need to, this is what I need to work on. This is what I need to do better. And so I always tell people you should embrace the failures, embrace not having as much success, because that's where the development, the growth, and the muscle building of leadership actually happens.
Yeah, I like to say that success is a horrible teacher. and you're absolutely right. And I, you know, word choice, but I don't like the word fail, because really you only fail when you quit trying. So yeah, you're allowed to struggle. You're allowed to grow. You're allowed to improve. And I think that people need to realize that growth happens on the fringes. Growth happens when you're uncomfortable. Growth happens when you don't know what you're doing. And have the confidence in yourself and the courage to go out there and do it, because courage is not executing in the absence of fear. Courage is executing despite the fear, and have that courage. But again, learn how to do it right. There's right ways and wrong ways to do all these skills. Go figure out how to do them right.
Ken, you've been doing this a long time. For our listeners, what is a common misconception or the biggest misconception that people have about executive or leadership coaching?
I think the biggest misconception is that, oh, I don't need a coach. I've been doing this for a long time. I'm good enough on my own. And again, I go back to the sports analogy. Everybody has a coach. Michael Jordan has a shooting coach. Tiger Woods has a stroke coach. It's about that misconception is that I don't need anybody else to look at it. To me, those are just people who are maybe a little bit uncomfortable with what might get discovered. And sure. So that misconception. The other one is that coaching is like counseling. And I like to tell people that counseling is great. I love it, but it tends to look backwards. What I, as a coach, not in a hard way, I don't care what got you here. All I care about is where you're going forward. Coaching is purely forward looking. And some people have that misconception that they got to dig into their past. Nope. All we need to know is where you're going forward.
And I want to pivot a little bit and move to a rapid fired question round. You mentioned earlier about books and how powerful and profound books can have on people and how many great books there are out there. What is one book that every leader should read?
Lead from the Heart by Mark Crowley.
Okay, and why?
Mark has a phenomenal job of really understanding that leadership isn't a matter of the mind. It's truly an exercise of the heart. He was way ahead of his time with a lot of groundbreaking research and a lot of real articulate thoughts. And as a human being, he's just a phenomenal person and really understands how leading with care and concern and heart is much more effective, and you're going to get better results than callousness and just straight drive.
For our listeners out there who want to, you know, begin this journey and really hone in their leadership skills, what is one leadership habit you swear by where they could get started?
I think that every single leader needs to have one meaningful conversation with every member of their team each week. And a meaningful conversation is not idle chit chat. It's not just seeing how they're doing, but one deep, valuable, meaningful conversation every single week with every single person.
If you could coach one historical figure, living or non-living, who would it be and why?
Well, so interesting. If I had one historical figure that I would want to talk to, it would be Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. So he was a colonel in the Civil War and was at the Battle of Gettysburg, but he was an orator. Professor, basically, not a professional soldier. And what he and his soldiers did throughout the time in service throughout the Civil War is pretty incredible and pretty amazing. I don't know how much coaching I'd be giving him, but I would certainly love to pick his brain and try to figure out, like, glean some of those characteristics in real life versus just what you've read, just what I read in books.
Ken, thank you so much for coming on the show. We're unfortunately out of time, and I would love to continue going, but thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and your wisdom. How can people find you?
So people can find me at belairleadership.com. It's B-E-L-A-I-R, like the car named after my 57 Chevy Bel Air. And they can reach me an email at ken@belairleadership.com.
Awesome. Well, that wraps up another great episode of the Career Can Do podcast. See you on the next one.
We thank you for tuning in to our Career Can Do podcast. We make no guarantees on results for your particular quest, but we hope you enjoy the information presented. The views and opinions expressed in this program are solely that of the guest or speaker and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of Varian Fairmouth and Fairmouth & Company. Thank you.
Welcome back to the nationally syndicated Price of Business show. I'm your host, Kevin Price, talking to you about you and your business, and love this conversation I'm about to have with Joan Hibden. She is a regular on the program, and she's an expert on feedback, which frankly is such a neglected and powerful topic. Feedback is treated in such a negative way, and frankly, there's a ton of confusion regarding that, and you can see it all over the place. Unfortunately, I watch news for a living as well as deliver news, and I look at the way the whole news process is done today, and man, there's something wrong with the feedback loop there. Joan, you are an expert in this area, and when I talk to you, you're like a beacon in a area that has been so greatly neglected, which is vital, which is feedback. A little bit about your business and your best website.
Yeah, thanks so much, Kevin. My business, what I do in my business is I do executive coaching and consulting, leadership consulting, and love what I do, so I get to play a lot and become an expert in certain areas. But my best website is www.jdhinsights, I-N-S-I-T, I'll spell it out, .com. Let me do that again. www.jdhinsights.com.
Yeah, and we have a link to that over at priceofbusiness.com. So by all means,
absolutely,
check out her work. Hey, let's get into this topic today. This is a really good one you've lined up for us. And I think that, we are so allergic, it seems like, as a culture these days, to feedback. We're too fragile, too sensitive, whatever you want to call it. And, of course, on a partisan perspective, both sides accuse the other of fragility. But, frankly, it's an entire cultural problem, in my opinion, that the reality is, like it or not, feedback, as you pointed out during the break, feedback's happening, if you know it cognitively or not.
Yeah, it's happening all the time. I mean, it's whether or not somebody is saying the words to you or actually just making a particular, I want to say a gesture, but gestures can be things like a raised eyebrow or a sigh or a silence with a particular facial expression. And it's invisible. It's invisible to us because we're not saying the words, hey, I'd like to give you some feedback. Is that okay with you? The feedback is coming all of the time if you only look for it.
Yes. Yes. And I'm sitting here listening to you as someone who is in leadership in my company. Not only am I the host and editor, producer of this show, I have a team that supports me in my media efforts that, sometimes I get frustrated by a lack, if you will, of overt feedback from them. But when I sit there and hear you, the reality is I'm getting constant feedback that if I just pause, if I look at it, and that doesn't mean I need to get paranoid, which can happen when it's not overt. You can start assuming, which is another form of problems. But you can learn a lot by simply listening.
Absolutely. One of the things, too, that you can see it and or you can listen. So a deep pause or a deep sigh. And when people do that, I think what happens is if, as leaders, we don't pick up on some of these nuances or the small things, then we're missing out on a whole thing. So as an example, if there's like a conversation going on and there's a really deep sigh, if the leader is listening well enough, they can say, hey, I noticed that you sighed. What is that coming from? And the person could say nothing. And a leader can say, okay, great, well, let's keep going on, which is expedient. But if a leader stops and says, hey, I'm interpreting that sigh as frustration, do you want to talk about that? Or, right, and just to step in and ask the question, like really listen to see what's going on there. Because if somebody is frustrated, but they're not going to say to you, hey, Kevin, I'm really frustrated about this change in the programming, You don't know that. You don't pick it up. But if somebody makes a particular sigh or a noise or a facial expression, if you notice it and say, what was that? And start to get curious, then it's possible that that person will open up and give you some feedback on why they're frustrated, as an example.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And what I like about that is that otherwise what you're doing it as a leader is you're leaving it to your own imagination. Oh, I see. He's not being honest with me. He's just saying nothing. You know, it's probably dot, dot, dot. I mean, let your imagination go to places it shouldn't go. And so you have a really good teachable opportunity right there for both of you, and you allow it to get squandered by that person's discomfort from going deeper and your willingness to go to places you probably shouldn't go when it comes to your staff. In the way you think about them, why not assume the best, but do the conversation, the hard ones.
Right. And sometimes when that happens, that you start to open it up enough so that in as a leader and in your business, you start to normalize the conversation. You start to normalize feedback. It's not even the conversation. You start to normalize feedback, where if you make it safe for your employees, I'm going to go back to my original example, to share that they're frustrated about something, and you open it up and allow them to give you feedback, then the next time you may not see the facial expression or hear the deep sigh, you may actually have words come out of their mouth saying, hey, hold on a second, Kevin, I'm really frustrated about this change in programming. Can we talk about it?
Yes.
And then it opens up that kind of conversation.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, again, we live, particularly generational wise, right? I sound more and more like my parents, you know, with age, who I used to mock for how old they sounded. There's a generational problem going on here. The younger they are, the more concern of negative consequences for being honest about what they think or feel. And some of that is silly, I think. There is a fragility that's been cultivated in our culture. Some of that is, really an unteachable culture that's not wanting real feedback, no matter what they say. And so it really requires leaders in particular to take the lead.
I would agree with that. I think the leaders do need to step in and take the lead and see what they can do to make it safe. And also, and I think a lot of times when we talk about the younger generation, it can be that in their lifetime, A, they weren't taught how to, socialize, normalize feedback. It could also be that they felt like for years that they were never heard. And so why start now?
Right.
And I don't know what the answer is. Yeah.
And I think, you know, this is not political, but I look at our adult authority culture, and this is a bipartisan problem, but there's not a whole lot of teachability being demonstrated by leaders that we see on a regular basis in the media.
I'm not going to disagree with you there. I think that there's something missing there for sure, and I'm not sure when it. Oh gosh. Well, I'm not sure exactly when it actually stopped existing. It's something that would be interesting to research, that's for sure. But I think that just the opportunity to have good conversations and communication between people. And exchange information that is either complimentary or critical, I think it's just so valuable for results and for relationships.
Yeah. Let's give the listener some talking, or rather some bullet points, if you will, some thoughts, some takeaway here on this topic real quick. And this is so crucial. I mean, I hadn't even thought about it, but this is why, you know, someone should look into hiring someone like you if they're not happy with the way communication is working within an office, because feedback is more than just, hey, I think dot, dot, dot. It really is the way we engage in general. So give us some marching orders, if you will.
Sure, absolutely. I think if you're a leader out there, I think one of the roles that I would encourage you to start to play is to play the role of inviting feedback asking people for feedback so that when it comes time for you to provide feedback that you are actually beginning to model it. And it can be as simple as saying to an employee, hey, I'd like to hear from you and I'd like some feedback. What are two things that I'm doing well? What are two things I could do better? And just start asking questions. So I think as a leader, start to be curious about the things that you're noticing and seeing in your business when it comes to communication, and then also begin to invite feedback from people that work for you. I think the other thing that I would say is for yourself is start to notice feedback all around you every day. Notice it in how you, when you're ordering a coffee from your favorite barista, notice the types of feedback that show up. Things like, thank you, you gave that coffee to me really fast. Or, thanks, you gave me the coffee and it's way too hot. Can you put an ice cube in it? Something like that. Notice every time you open a door for somebody, what is the person saying to you? What is their smile saying? What are their words saying? That's a form of feedback. So I think the marching orders, Kevin, more than anything, would be to start going out and noticing when you are either giving feedback in your real life or when you're noticing feedback coming to you, and are you capturing those feedback moments?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I had in one of your our interviews, one of our conversations of feedback that came in that was pertaining to you, where they were asking about, you know, the circumstances that companies hire your services. What's usually going on there? I thought that was a very interesting question. I feel like we may have covered it some, but that was an interesting feedback.
Well, typically when companies are hiring my services, it's because they have heard about who I am as an executive coach and how I help leaders in their business. The other thing is often just for leadership development in general. Things like communication skills, or somebody might have seen me speaking or heard me on a podcast, and they're curious about my style and who I am as a facilitator, a consultant, the different ways that I look at things. And so it's really around how I can help to cultivate better leadership in organizations.
Yeah, I love that. I love that you do this. And it's such it's such a huge need for it, and I wish it was more of a cognitive need, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to do this series, is because I think people don't really know what they're missing when it comes to the importance of feedback in their business. Mm-hmm. I get wondering, maybe this is a future segment because we are running out of time, you know. I wonder how bad the business shape is in by the time they reach you. Because we don't live in a culture that naturally thinks, in my opinion, hey, we need to just go in this direction. What you do is so cutting edge, so fundamental, and so imperative, yet I don't see a lot of it. I don't see it demonstrated a lot as important. And so that's why what you do is so crucial. Went a little over, but you're worth it. Final thought from you, and give your website one more time, Joan.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Kevin. My website is www.jdhinsights.com. And boy, it's been a pleasure today, Kevin. I appreciate your time and your openness and feedback as well.
Yeah, likewise. That's kind of the foundation of our relationship, and I appreciate that. I appreciate you,
Me
Joan.
Too.
I am Kevin Price. This is the nationally syndicated Price of Business. Remember, it's a show that never ends. Check it out 24/7 as we always add new audio, video, articles, and more at priceofbusiness.com.
That wraps up another Price of Business. I am glad to be with you. Really enjoyed it and enjoying our new home here on these stations around the country. I do want to remind you that the show continues 24/7. Not only do we have this weekly show that you can hear on this station, but we're on other stations around the country with a daily program as well. You can easily learn about them by visiting us at priceofbusiness.com. We affectionately say it is the show that never ends. And what we mean by that is that it continues 24/7 with the addition of new audio, video, articles, and more at priceofbusiness.com. While there, we'd like you to engage with us on social media. Follow us on Facebook and, like us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Kevin Price Live and all of our sister sites as well. All right, I'm going to take a break until next time. Next week, we'll be back with you with much more information for you, and look forward to that conversation. And I want to say, again, thank you to USA Business Radio to make it possible for this to have been commercial-free, an entire hour of commercial-free. And guess what? Even more commercial-free than public radio. So we're excited about that. Enjoy the rest of your day right here on this station.